I'm Stephen Kent. I'm a neuroscientist working in the School of Psychological Science at La Trobe University, and you're listening to a La Trobe University podcast.
Hello, everyone. I'm Matt Smith, and welcome to a La Trobe University podcast. Today, we're powering up La Trobe's Wayback Machine, and we're going back to 2008 to our very first La Trobe University podcast. It's with Professor Lynn Crace. He's now the director of the Center for Water Policy and Management at La Trobe University. And at the time, he'd just released a book.
Water Policy in Australia, The Impact of Change and Uncertainty, in all good bookstores.
He joined me to discuss water trading. And besides the major players, it kind of shows that in the last 6 years, nothing much has changed.
I did a bit of reading beforehand. In Melbourne, for example, our water restrictions at the moment are level 3A, which essentially means that people can only water their yards on certain days if there are a certain number house, no spitting, no internal bleeding. We've got things like that going on. Our water storage is currently at 32.9%. I looked that up this morning. And one interesting thing I found that is essentially we've got to ration the water that we've got.
The question is how you go about rationing water. What you need to understand though, I think, and listeners would need to understand is that we've already allocated a very large quantum of this water to particular sectors, to particular groups. And the reason that's come about primarily is because historically Australians thought it a noble thing to do to allocate water to agriculture. Agriculture was seen as a noble activity, particularly in the early 1900s and late 1800s. It was seen as a social policy to relocate people to inland Australia to develop an irrigation sector and therefore have all these noble yeomans working on the land. The upshot of that is once you've allocated the resource, it's then very difficult to reallocate it to other users. And of course, the urban population has grown, urban demands have grown, and what we're struggling with at the moment is coming to grips with the fact that we've created a sector around allocating water to agriculture and now trying to reallocate that water away from agriculture to other urban users is a really difficult political problem. So what we currently have is we have a situation where we have restrictions, quite severe restrictions imposed on urban communities, primarily because we haven't come to grips with how we reallocate water away from agriculture.
So is this where the water trading is going to come into play?
This is where water trading can play a big part. And in fact, in some parts of the state, it does play a big part. The difficulty is, of course, Melbourne has been largely locked out of some of that trading. So if you look at the north of the state, where I come from, Wodonga, which is on the Murray system, we are connected with irrigation. So in those towns, we've been trading water into those towns so that some users are basically able to avoid restrictions. This is just the market working to allocate the resource away from agriculture. Now, the people who have sold access to that water were quite happy with the money they received, and the people who are now using it to save very expensive investments in things like bowling greens or community assets, they're better off as well. So the market's actually working. That's how a market's supposed to work. It's supposed to make everybody better off.
Essentially, water that's been allocated to rural uses, and because they've got a surplus or they don't need to use all the water that they've allocated, they're able to therefore sell this water on or to trade it on?
Yeah, or the individual seller makes a rational decision. Take a dairy farmer. I realise a lot of people in Melbourne probably don't know much about dairy farming, but you don't have to use water to produce milk per se. I mean, you can substitute grain for water. So instead of using water to grow grass for your cows to eat so that you can have milk, the alternative is to buy in fodder or to buy in grain. So you actually have a substitute. Instead of using their water, they can sell their water to an urban community and then use the income to buy in grain or hay from other sources. The other thing you need to understand, I think, is that in Victoria we have a very strange perception of what high-value agriculture is. We think that high-value agriculture is fruit trees and grapevines and things like this. That may be the case now, but I'd ask you to think about what's it going to be like in an era of climate change when we have 30% less streamflow, which means these grapevines or these fruit trees that need water every year face the real prospect of not having any water in some years. So is this going to be really high-value agriculture? I'd suggest to you that high-value agriculture is more likely to be an agricultural system that you can turn off in a really dry year sell the water to places like Melbourne, and then in a wet year, turn the agriculture back on. In Victoria, we've got this really strong mindset that somehow high-value agriculture is only perennial crops, you know, things that keep that require water every year. I don't think that's going to be the case for the future.
But won't that, therefore, damage a lot of businesses in the rural community as far as, well, you used grape growing as an example? That will damage it during years when there's low water.
Regrettably, I'm an economist, so words like damage, you know, mean different things to different people. The structural adjustment's a fact of life, you know. The reality is that resources will never stay in the same use year in, year out. That's like arguing that, you know, if your children grow up in regional Australia, they're not allowed to move to Melbourne to get a job. So water's a resource. So if you think about it in those terms, sure, it's going to move around and industries will contract and others will expand. That's how a vibrant economy is supposed to respond to change. If you try to fiddle with the resource allocation, there's only one thing you'll guarantee, and that is we'll all end up poorer. Sorry, but that's the economics of it.
They'll protest to it.
Of course they'll protest to it, and that's part of the political system. But you've got to make a judgment between the protests that people in agricultural areas are going to make about the reallocation of resource and the protests that urban people are going to make about not having enough water. You know, there's a balancing act here. There's another thing to understand about this which is often overlooked. There are a good number of willing sellers we're talking about here. We're not actually talking about going and taking something from somebody who doesn't want to sell it. So often the people you hear who are most vocal are those involved in agriculture.
Who have something to lose.
Who have a lot to lose. Yeah. The farmer who's really struggling, who wants to get out and wants to sell and get the best price he can, is obviously a clear contender for selling. And what you're really advocating is to lock that person into poverty. Now, I don't see that as a particularly rational policy response. To me, a rational policy response is you allow the market to help better allocate the resource, and then if that generates wealth and you're concerned about adjustment, you don't redistribute the resource, you redistribute the wealth to account for that concern. So you always deal with social policy by using things like taxation on income and wealth. You don't fiddle with the allocation of the resource per se. I know that sounds very bland, but that's how an economist looks at the world.
So we've talked about water trading for farming. How about on a smaller scale, maybe between households? Do you think that water trading might be able to work on that level?
Well, there's a lot of work at the moment looking at the viability of that. Personally, I think what economists call welfare gains, the benefits, if you like, the benefits that are to be had from inter-household trade are really, really small compared to the benefits from just breaking down this divide between agricultural water use in Victoria and urban water use. You know, the magnitude of gains of being able to transfer a modest amount of water away from agriculture to urban use, the welfare gains from that are, in my mind, and it's an empirical question, in other words, somebody's got to do the numbers on it, but in my mind, the gains from that are enormous compared to the little gains by you selling me a bit of water and me being able to water my fruit tree or my lemon tree or fill up my pool, you know. And the other thing you have to bear in mind is the transaction costs, you know. How much is it actually going to cost to administer a policy like that versus simply trying to free up the trade between urban and agricultural users? Now, the Victorian government has put in place this north-south pipeline, which is creating a lot of controversy, and you've heard of the Plug the Pipe group. This is a group that's trying to prevent the north-south pipeline and prevent the capacity to move water. I think the pipeline's a great idea. One of the things that does bother me, though, the way they've managed to achieve this is they're talking about the rejuvenation of the food bowl as the payoff. So they're building the north-south pipeline. They're pacifying country voters by saying, we're going to rejuvenate your irrigation district to help offset this. I think that's a nonsense. I think the offsets are more in the minds of the politicians than they are real. Again, if you come back to thinking about 30% less stream flow, if you go and invest all this money in irrigation to make it less leaky, it's not going to make any difference. You need to have water to put in the channel. I think the whole concept of rural urban trade is a really good one. I think it's better to do it with a market mechanism than some engineer trying to tell us how much water he's going to save by putting a bit of concrete in a channel.
If I could throw a quote at you, This is from John Howard. He said it in April last year. "It's all very serious. It's unprecedented in my lifetime, and I really feel deeply for the people affected. So we should all, literally and without irony, pray for rain over the next 6 to 8 weeks." What do you think about the current policies as far as water solution goes? Do you think the Rudd government's going to have the right approach here?
Well, it's early days, but what we've seen from Penny Wong, I think many of my colleagues would not regard as particularly encouraging. We had a national water plan, which was cobbled together at the last minute, you know, and I think most commentators would argue that, you know, the national water plan certainly was a demonstration of panic by the government at the time to try and offer a solution besides praying for rain, which is just about as good. It was cobbled together quickly without the gaze of Treasury, and to many people who looked at it, it was a significant waste of public money. One of the things that bothered me and some of my colleagues at the time was that the balance seemed to be all wrong. We were actually spending $3 billion to buy back entitlements and spending $7 billion on infrastructure. That was the basic balance. And as far as I can tell from the announcements from current federal ministers, I don't think they've radically altered that balance. As I've already indicated, investing a lot of money in infrastructure is not going to count for very much if you have 30% less streamflow. And the way the accounting is done on this, it's actually quite false. They pretend they're creating water with investments in infrastructure. All you're really doing is preventing water moving to where it was previously used.
That's Professor Lynn Crace, Director of the Centre for Water Policy and Management at La Trobe University. And he also joined me for the 100th La Trobe University podcast, and he's delivered public lectures as well. We'll put links to those on our podcast blog. That's at podcast.blogs.latrobe.edu.au. I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.